Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, my radio listeners. You are getting it right with Dr. Bowles. I hope your afternoon has been going well. I was just talking to my colleague, who will be joining me in a few minutes, of how things are going on in these United States are a little topsy-turvy. There are places in California that's getting fires because it's too dry, and places in South Carolina, people are losing everything because of what they're saying, biblical, almost biblical flooding going on. The irony of this whole story is it's not a hurricane that brought it in like it did in 2005 with Hurricane Katrina, or I think a 2007 Hurricane Sandy. They can't really justify why so much water is coming in on South Carolina, parts of North Carolina, since Hurricane Joaquin, I think they named it, is still very well offshore. There are those who would say it is the wickedness of these United States that are bringing the scourges upon us, and I chuckle, although I have some belief in karma. Today's topic, however, is something near and dear to my heart. I have spoken out against mass incarceration and extended incarceration in the United States, and more specifically in Louisiana, and it felt like it was falling on deaf ears. And then when all of a sudden marijuana began to get legalized, I could not help but feel the pain of how many young black men particularly may be doing a life sentence for selling marijuana in certain quantities, and this would be their third offense. If those of you who don't follow history, it was President Bill Clinton who signed into law third strike, which meant if you had had two previous incarcerations and you were on a felony for your third time, you got life imprisonment. I never thought that was fair. I thought it was unconstitutional. And in today's discourse, if you've read the marquee that I published, I learned, and I don't know if you already knew it, that there was something called the Sentencing Commission here in these United States. That shook me a little bit because I was thinking that a jury made a decision about guilty, and then the type of punishment dealt out, I thought, was either understood or written somewhere. I didn't know that there was a special commission of people who rambled around making decisions on how long your loved one would be incarcerated. Now, don't get me wrong, for high-profile crimes, murder, rape, kidnapping, these extreme, harsh things, I can see. But I have never thought marijuana selling was any worse than selling alcohol during prohibition. I don't use either. I don't advocate either, but I also don't think punishment was being levied out equal to the crime, and that is supposedly the premise for our Constitution of the United States. And with all that rant and raving, I will now welcome my guest, Ms. Cassandra Bell Gash, whom you have heard from on a couple of the broadcasts, and I'm delighted she's joining me this afternoon. How are you, Cassandra?
Doing well. Thanks, Dr. Bowles.
Well, what do you think about all of this?
It's a lot. I was reading the marquee, and I was focusing on thinking and brainstorming about what it will take to reintegrate folks into society. So that's kind of where my thoughts were lingering today. The information that you provided is very informative. I must admit that I have not paid close attention to what's happening with the release of the prisoners and what the laws are saying about it. But I've had a limited amount of experience working with folks who had been incarcerated, who came in for outpatient services due to being unable to deal with the stress of what it means to be integrated into the community, not just the community itself, but back with their families, looking for employment, just trying to figure out how to meet their daily expenses because of having a record not being employable. So that's more so the end in which I've had a little bit of experience from.
Well, see, that's what I meant by I'd be interested in seeing how much the government is going to really clean up this act. Because, listeners, you may or may not know that when you come out of prison and you have on your record a felony, there are a number of things you are not allowed to do in these United States. If you are on parole and the government has not released you, you cannot vote. Now, the irony to that, Cassandra, is you can't vote, but they will tax your income. And again, to me, I thought that was the very premise of why the Constitution and the break from Britain is taxation without representation. There is this large body of people here in this United States who, because they're on parole, get their money taxed by state and federal, but do not have the right to vote. So I really jumped up and down on that one when I was taking a few legal courses that I have taken through the various legal schools, Loyola being one of them. But I never understood, how can we impose things that are unconstitutionally yet run back to Second Amendment every time we talk about guns? There are so many violations which the government perpetrates and never talks about, and I wonder why our so-called leaders, I'm speaking to the black community now, never bring up these kinds of travesties, because unfortunately, as you know, Cassandra, a majority of the incarcerated in the United States are black Americans. It is disproportional to the percentage which are recorded by census every year. So mm-hmm. my comment was, they're releasing them. Are they going to expunge them? Will their felony records be expunged? And that is a very important statement. Will they be able to get a job? Because Walmart will not hire an ex-felon. You cannot be a substitute teacher as an ex-felon. There are so many things in the United States that literally ostracizes, even after you've served your time, whatever punishment supposed to have been levied out, you are still continuously punished when you come out of the institution, which sets you up to go back, by the way, because if you can't get a job, you can't earn money, so how are you supposed to live? And it continues to alienate the family, because if there is a male coming out of prison who cannot get a job, how is he supposed to have the traditional family? So I put that out there that, yes, you're releasing them. They wrote in my sources how 2,000 of the 6,000 people that are being released by the end of November, 1st of November, are even American. They have over 2,000 people in our prison system being held for drug charges who are not even American. Now, the irony to me is, people, your tax dollars are paying for that imprisonment. Take it to them, boom. Every meal, every bath, every officer that's being paid through our penal system is tax money. So they're admitting that we have this huge number of persons who have never contributed financially to the United States government, who I won't say benefit, but certainly is taking money out of the coffers for the United States citizens. There's a whole lot in this little bit. I mean, I thought this was a short, relatively short write-up, but it hit so many notes with me, Cassandra, that I said, I know we've been talking social justice, and to me, this reflects social injustice, that you can't have a disproportionate number of people sentenced to some exorbitant number of years of incarceration. And here's a ringer. The United States government benefits from the incarcerated. They are traded on the stock market. And in a lot of states now, they have privatized the prisons. So with all that said, my long-windedness, Cassandra, let me hear from you. What do you think about the dynamic with respect to social justice? What will happen when 4,000 Americans reenter the scene, all carrying a felony on their record? Some of them may have never seen a cell phone, because keep in mind, cell phones only became the vogue in the last decade. They may have no concept of Wi-Fi or some of the more modern things we take for granted. What would you think would be a reasonable reparation to a body of people who have been excised from the society for things now accepted as non-criminal acts?
I would first suggest those persons who are coming up for parole, those persons who are coming up to be released, if they could be part of some type of 6, 8, 12-week pre-integration program in which they are introduced from within inside the penal system to things that they could expect once they are released. I believe that would be a good place to start as opposed to them being released and then scuffling around to the local Department of Social Services, the health department, mental health, you know, scavenging around trying to find out what exists. So if someone was going to be released from prison, put on parole, that they would have some type of preliminary opportunity to interface with some of the things that they're going to see once they are discharged or once they are released. I would suggest that. Also, upon being released from prison, I found that the limited amount, and I do say limited amount of folks that I've had the opportunity to work with, they seem to have done better by becoming self-employed because of the issue of having a charge, having a felony, and not being able to find gainful employment. So these persons that I'm referencing have become barbers. They've become owners of car detail shops. They've become mechanics. They've become landscapers, things where they can have their own business so they can take care of their families, because it is hard and challenging to go look for jobs and then have a certain criminal record and not be hired as a result. It is especially challenging for folks to work in the human services field, interfacing with people when you've had certain crimes. So all of that within itself is extremely challenging, but I would strongly suggest that if there was programs that existed prior to folks' release that would begin to shed some light on some things that they could face, even in having some family sessions, identifying the support system for the prisoner prior to being released would also benefit and be helpful.
Well, what is interesting, the argument is the existing halfway houses that are now in place in the U.S. are sufficient. And I jump up and shout no, because halfway houses, and I do have some personal experience with this, they charge the then almost ex-inmate for transportation, for food. They do very marginal assistance in getting them jobs. They are really watched and curfewed and so forth, but there is no transition information. In other words, if I were in charge, I'm going to be czar for the moment, I would expect that there is a psychological thing you have to make an adjustment. If you live in an 8x8 cell with another man or another woman for a number of years, you're not socialized. I know when children go to school, the reason we have Head Start and the reason we have kindergarten is the whole concept of them going into a classroom for learning, they have to have a socialization. And I have not seen it addressed anywhere. And keep in mind, this decision was made November 2014. So they've had a year. And you're in social services, and I have my finger on the pulse of social services and judicial programs. I have not seen any surge, no effort. I haven't seen anything new saying, okay, we are gearing up, we're preparing to integrate a group of people who may come out angry. Can you imagine having a 15-year sentence for crack cocaine, and now they turn around and say, well, you know, powder cocaine would have only gotten you 4 years incarceration, and it really is unfair to give you 15 years when it's only 15% cocaine. And I asked this question 9 years ago, by the way. How can you sentence more years for a less of a product? And you know what I was told, Cassandra? They said people who buy crack are poor. And the likelihood of them doing collateral, listen to this, collateral criminal acts are very high. So if we get them off the street, we will potentially improve our neighborhoods and have less crime. So I remember standing up and asking a professor, so you're incarcerating someone for their potential crime. And he just looked at me. This was the reasoning used to send someone to prison for a 15%, because crack cocaine is 15% cocaine, and the remaining percentage is usually a base, which is usually bicarbonate of soda or some other base compound to form the rock salt. So you go to prison longer for a 15% quantity of a drug than you would with 100% quantity of the drug, because the people making the decision for punishment are preemptively punishing you because you're poor. Now, that very language to me was a social injustice. That you are poor and using a cheaper form of this drug, you are more likely to commit a crime to get the money to buy the drug, so I'm going to punish you more harshly. Now, what is that? I don't even know how else to weigh it. I just remember sitting there looking at Professor thinking, wow.
He goes to show the prejudice and biases and injustices cost more than lines of race, you know, socioeconomic status, all of that comes into play. That's very unfortunate to hear. It really is, that people would have to serve a larger sentence or a longer, more extensive sentence because of their potential of being hazardous to the community because of their lack of resources and income.
Well, I mean, now we can really jump in when you start talking about social injustice. And those who have what I would say the modicum of comfort in the United States usually don't know of things that I'm talking about now. Because if you don't venture forth to investigate something out of your comfort zone, it doesn't exist. And I've had a number of debates from people who are philanthropic, and they'd say, well, I'll give to a concert or I'll give to the development of arts, but no, I'm not interested in feeding people in underserved countries, and no, I'm not interested in educating. And I once went, you know, rather aggressively at a colleague, and I said, why? I said, well, they shouldn't have been born anyway. I didn't know what to say. I said, oh. So there is very much, even when persons don't claim prejudice, there's this aristocratic kind of thinking when those who have enough to eat, a wonderful home, perhaps the ideal 2.5 children, whatever that means, and they have a profession that allows them to take off a paid leave and they can do their vacationing. America, and I think we talked about this more last week, have become this very entitled group. The generations today, I had a friend once, I don't even know what happened to him, but I enjoyed our conversation because he was so skewed. If you look at the Gaussian curve, some people are down the middle, some is on the north end, some is on the south end. Well, he was definitely on one of the skewed ends, because when we would talk, and I have to say I'm probably more liberal, significantly more liberal than he, but more liberal than many. And we would be talking, and I'd have all these altruistic ideas. I'm going to volunteer for this, I'd say, or I'm going to work for this for free, blah, blah. And finally, without him giving me much feedback, I said, well, what do you feel about all that? And his comment was, how does any of that affect me directly? I didn't know what to say. It's like, well, yeah, you don't breastfeed, so you wouldn't have to worry about women not breastfeeding. And, yeah, you don't have HIV/AIDS, so you don't have to worry about administering care to HIV/AIDS. And, no, you don't live in a destitute country where food is, very sparse and water is limited. So your answer to me is, if it does not affect you directly, you have no interest in the conversation. You have no interest in the, perpetuation of good deeds. And I think that too many offspring came out with his mentality, because the modern day young person too often has that attitude, that it's sufficient if it doesn't affect my everyday life, then I don't really have to be involved. I told you the comment when I was watching a public television station where they were talking to young people about racism, and a very attractive white female, a sophomore in college, was asked about race relations. She looked at the speaker and said, it doesn't affect me, I'm white. If we
I had a dynamic lesson on race relations through my daughter this week. It's kind of cute in a way. She shared with her dad that she had a crush on a classmate. And when I heard the classmate's name, I assumed that it was Caucasian descent. And I was correct. And so she didn't tell the little fella that she had a crush on him. One of her friends did. And his report back was, he can't date black girls. Woo! And that was my daughter's first time experiencing what it means to be black.
I'm just curious. Now you know I got to chase that. What was her emotional response to that?
Her emotional response was, she told him, what she said to me was, she told him didn't really matter because she couldn't date white boys. And I told her.
Well, what do you think her inner self was? Do you think, was she reporting correctly or just responding emotionally?
She was responding emotionally. I have attempted, and the upper word is attempted, to raise a child unlike how I was raised, you know, letting her make her choices based on the nature, the spirit of a human being and who treats her well, and being friends and being nice to people who are nice to her, and showing people kindness even if they're not nice. You don't have to have a relationship with them, but being mindful and respectful of all persons. But it was interesting to see her reaction. She did not verbalize her feelings, but the look on her face was one of despair and hurt, in which she presented as if she felt lesser.
Hmm.
And so,
well, that's what I'm saying. The big lesson, and I do want you to continue, is in 2015, and you're talking in children under the age of 12 or 13, I know she's not really a teenager yet, that somebody is propagating this kind of thinking in this generation. You know, some would say racism is gone, there's no need for this and no need for that. Definitely there's need. You know, it showed up in Charleston, South Carolina, when this young man drove from Columbia and killed black people in their church. And now it's closer in the home. From your point of view, someone you love dearly is expressing a natural hormonal response and get told your color is a determining factor. I mean, that's
exactly.
Just hurtful on any level.
It is. But what it showed me was that I was naive in my thinking that we had gotten past something, you know.
Now, you and I have had that discourse, that being
we have, we have. And
yeah.
What it showed me is that even though it may not raise its ugly head as often, it is still present and it is still there, and it's being taught. It's being encouraged. You know,
yes.
It's not something that's haphazardly happening. It's being taught. It's being encouraged. It's being passed down from generation to generation. And makes it relevant is all of that, one's mindset, one's upbringing, one's thoughts, one's family of origins, all of that, all behavior is learned. And we become a product of our environment and what we've been taught, whether it lands you in prison, whether it lands you in the Senate, whether it lands you chief of a hospital, wherever it lands you, everything that we become is a product, a byproduct of what we've been taught and where we've been.
Well, see, what you're saying, and I'm going to step out, maybe this will be next week's show, my comment here is, this is all the more reason why we cannot be tacit. And for those saying, what the world is at, that means silent. That the comment, I forget, I think I'm quoting Martin Luther King Jr., what he says, all evil needs to do to triumph is to have those who do good say nothing. And I really think that's true, that when you think we don't have to do race relations discussions, and when you think that it doesn't have to be a governmental legislation about equality and diversity and so forth, we are wrong. We either must separate, and I mean, I know this is a wild card, but this is what they did with the Native American. They said, here's your reservation, you govern yourself, this is our treaty. And essentially they cut the people off, but they were able to maintain tradition or at least some historical perspective of tradition. When you look at the black American, we are trying to integrate in to a very system that hated us. I mean, we were cattle to them. We were animal. We were not human. And now there are this faction saying, oh, it doesn't matter anymore. The color thing doesn't matter. And I stand up very firmly and say, you are absolutely wrong. And I've seen it on both sides of the door. Now, what do I mean by that? I have been that black, nappy-headed little girl that someone ran over with a bicycle when I was about 9 or 10 years old simply because the young white males had power. We had no one to complain to. And I've had a brother as an adult come to me and tell me how helpless he felt when he watched these young men on bicycles come up behind us. We were walking from school and speed up, and literally they hit me with the bike, and I skipped my elbows and my knees. And, you know, Brother Jerry, he confessed to me how helpless he felt at seeing them traumatize me and not being able to do anything to stop it or prevent it. So if that happens when I was 9 and now here we are in 2015, and although your daughter was not traumatized by a bicycle physically, she has some emotional, even if she didn't buy into it, and I know your family would justify and balance her back out, that little injury is there, injury nonetheless. And I just defy anyone to stand up and profess that in these United States of America, race does not matter. And that's false on every level. When I said I've had on either door, when I was little, I remember it as being that little black, nappy-headed girl. And now when I can go into the boardrooms and I can sit in the leather chairs and I can listen to those who have degrees and money, they are, in effect, treating many times a black American community like a child. They will say, this is what we're going to do for them. This is what we're going to allow them to do. And I would sit and think, why are you making decisions for a people? How do you feel it's not necessary to confer or investigate or involve yourself? I never understood it. I worked for Westinghouse, and Westinghouse was a very good employer for me. But I can remember when they had fellowships and foundations for programs in the summer, they would have at least 50 to 60% would be given out in a nepotism way. Somebody's aunt, cousin, you know, nephew, son would get all the benefits, and what few were still left for the low socioeconomic child was abysmal, when the program itself was designed to help the lower socioeconomic group. So I'm sorry that happened to your daughter. I know she's a fine young lady. I'm sorry that the young man's been taught that kind of hate. But I know it's alive and well.
In thinking about it, you know, as you're talking, and we've had much discussion about race relationships and the issue with race in these United States of America. And so you're looking at that as it relates to being released from prison, and what is the plight for the African American, the black person who is dealing with issues of race, as well as how do they become integrated back into society. So it's not even just about your criminal record, but it's about your criminal record and lack of resources and lack of natural support, and then you're a black female, and then you're a black male. All of that together is a lot for one person to contend with.
I mean, it's an inherent anger. I would be really angry that I had 3-5 years invested in a prison system away from my family, away from my parents, my children, my wife, my girlfriend, because some commission decided that crack cocaine should be punished more harshly than powder cocaine. Well, Cassandra, guess what? We're out of time. I always enjoy our discussions, and I look forward to when we can have our next one. And listeners, I hope that you've learned some things, at least about what's going on in these United States and will happen over the next few weeks with respect to release of incarcerated persons. And with that, I thank you, Cassandra, for joining me. And I thank you, listeners, for being part of this. And until next time, take care now. Bye.